coming up on Weekend America.
Leaders of 20 nations are in Washington to address the global economic crisis. Saudi Arabia will be there.
King Abdullah is going to deliver a strong message. He's going to tell the world that we have plenty of oil and we are going to deliver, so trust us.
And hey, if you're tired of hearing how bad things are from the American media, perhaps you'd prefer China's approach.
You do not report on problems before they're solved. And we've seen a certain amount of that with the Chinese media in the financial crisis.
I'm John Moe. Also this hour, we look at what stress does to kids, and we ask, why should fans root for one basketball team over another? NBA players and executives make their pitch.
I am absolutely welcoming you into our franchise. We could use some fans right now, and yeah, you're part of the blueprint, absolutely.
You don't even need a decent jump shot to listen to Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Planning to catch a ball game this weekend? Football, basketball? Hey, it's fun to care about sports, but do those players care about you? Or even know who you are? Well, what if they did? This hour, we turn the tables. I challenge NBA teams to recruit me as a fan. Prove yourself, pro athletes. Tell me why you deserve my love. Turning the tables on you there. The old switcheroo. Also, Obama administration critics. Yep, they're out there already. And kids may not have jobs, but they sure do have stress. And researchers are learning more about what it does to them. What stresses you out?
Lately, one of my biggest stress factors has been repetitive beeping that most machines and cars and things seem to do all the time.
Computers stress me out.
Believe it or not, telephone ringing.
A pain in my back, which I occasionally convince myself is cancer.
Really, the only thing that stresses me out is money.
It's my home improvement project that we took on before all of this economic turmoil. I'm really ready for this little project to be over with.
Nothing like these financial times to send you over close to the edge a little bit.
Man, now I'm stressed out just listening to those stressed out voices from St. Paul, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Concord, New Hampshire, Denver, San Francisco, and Birmingham, Alabama. Leaders of 20 major industrialized nations are in Washington, D.C. this weekend, attempting to come up with a multilateral approach to the global economic catastrophe that's going on. A lot of people and a lot of markets are going to be watching these meetings closely. Coming up with a solution is a tall order in one weekend, of course, but you got to start somewhere. During his tenure as economist for the International Monetary Fund, Ken Rogoff got to know his way around these economic summits. He teaches economics at Harvard and joins us now. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you.
So once the press leaves, once all the pictures are taken and everybody waves and walks inside the room and the doors close, what happens on the other side of those doors?
Well, to be honest, where they have the big meetings, not much. I mean, you do get a pulse of the world. They will each speak. They're going to be largely prepared texts. And I think it'd be pretty interesting to hear. I mean, even if you study these things, just hearing from Saudi Arabia, Brazil, Turkey, Italy, just hearing each of their perspectives is kind of interesting. They also have opportunities here for what they call bilateral meetings, meaning one-on-one or one-on-two. And I think that's where they're looking to close the big deals.
What are the stakes this weekend?
Well, I mean, the global economy is in just awful shape and it's a danger of going off a cliff. And they need to appear to be doing something. It's very, very hard to actually get something done in a gigantic meeting like this with heads of state and from 20 countries.
And it comes at kind of an interesting time in U.S. leadership. And what will the status of Bush and Obama mean in this particular meeting?
I actually think it's a good thing because often the U.S. is so dominant, even out of proportion to our size, we're the gorilla in these things. We really could use some creativity here. Do you have a big spending fiscal policy? Do you do tax cuts? How aggressively should you do monetary policy? How do you restart the banking system? And I think it's a good thing to give space for other countries to give their ideas instead of having the U.S. dominate so much because I think really that might lead to a better solution, not just for the rest of the world, but for us.
How should we best read this situation and figure out exactly what went on? What should the watchwords and the signals be that we can look for to judge how the weekend went?
I expect that we'll have to read between the lines of what they say. For example, how are they going to deal with global poverty? The African countries are experiencing a catastrophic situation. Are they going to reinforce the role of the International Monetary Fund? It's been much, much weakened. Its big problem is that it doesn't have enough representation of Asia. It's just way overweighted in Europe. I would be floored if we actually saw some movement there, but the crisis is so severe, it's just possible. Maybe the Chinese, the Indians, and the Brazilians will manage to negotiate something. I mean, of course, the most likely thing is that we'll just be told that they care a lot and they're going to try very hard.
Ken Rogoff is a professor of economics at Harvard. Ken Rogoff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone at that summit hopes the global economy can improve, of course, but each nation has its own agenda. To get a feel for what's in play this weekend, we're going to hop through a few time zones and continents here and look at the summit from different national perspectives. Our first guests join us from the world's top two oil-producing countries. Abdullah Al-Alami is an economic researcher based in Saudi Arabia. Welcome to Weekend America.
Well, thank you.
And Konstantin Sonin is an assistant professor at the New Economics School in Moscow. Welcome to Weekend America, Konstantin.
Hi.
Abdullah, I'll start with you. Going into this weekend summit, what's on the agenda for Saudi Arabia? What are they hoping to accomplish?
Well, I think King Abdullah is going to deliver a strong message. He's going to tell the world that we have plenty of oil and we are going to deliver, so trust us. We are also suffering. Just the fact that we are the largest oil producer country in the world does not necessarily mean that we are outside the financial crisis. We are suffering as well. Some of our projects are going to be delayed. Oil prices are going down. So he's going to say, I think we are all in the same boat.
And Konstantin Sonin, what about Russia? What are they trying to accomplish this weekend?
I think for Russian leaders, it's extremely important to assert the Russian role in world affairs. So they basically would push forward like a very ambitious geopolitical agenda. So they will try to abstain from talking about economic, particular economic issues, and probably they would try to become a kind of a voice of non-American countries, like of countries that are outside of the American sphere of influence.
What will a successful summit look like from the point of view of your respective governments?
Generally, the big success of this summit is already in the fact that countries like China, Saudi Arabia, Australia, India, the countries that play a major role, probably not lesser than those that are already in the G7 group, they're invited. And this is, I think, the biggest success. And from the Russian standpoint, the main success will be if the Russian voice will be heard and will be heard, say, unproportionately to our contribution to the world gross product.
Abdullah Al-Alami?
Well, you know, I think the message, like I say, that the king is going to deliver is not only for international purposes, but also for local purposes. Like the American dream, the average American citizen would like to own a house and have a good job. Just like that, an average Saudi citizen would like to, you know, get a job, a decent job. He'd like to own his own home and maybe raise a good family and have his kids go through some quality education with some quality medical care. That's probably the average Saudi dream. So the message that the king is going to deliver, the level of success is how will the average Saudi citizen react to that, not only how the rest of the world will react to the Saudi king assurances, but how will the average Saudi citizen also react to the message.
Abdullah Al-Alami and Konstantin Sonin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for hosting us.
We heard Konstantin Sonin mention China there, a nation that comes up pretty quickly in any international financial discussion. China's economy is still growing despite the global crisis, but it is slowing down, and that has the government concerned. This week, the Chinese government announced what it called a $586 billion stimulus package. Some of that spending isn't really new money, but it's still a big package. At the same time, the government doesn't want anyone to think this is an emergency move. They don't want to start a panic. I spoke with Jocelyn Ford, an independent journalist based in Beijing, and I asked her what signs of a slowdown she's seeing there.
You know, in my neighborhood, interestingly enough, the first sign was from the recycling industry. Now, in China, what happens is that this is a job where people come into the city from the countryside. They're driving these tricycle carts. They come door to door and they pay you for your empty plastic water bottles, your empty tin cans, your old newspapers, and then they cart them out to the suburbs to a big, huge, massive piles of junk, and they sell it there and they make money on the price in between. Well, I heard that, you know, shortly after the Olympics around September, the price of all of this waste had just fallen so much that that a lot of these people were out of a job, essentially, couldn't make a living. But everyone else has been, you know, a lot of people have been fairly optimistic. Oh, China can, you know, China's different. And in part, you know, China's finance banks are still fairly closed off to the world economy. But in part, that's also because of what I call the happy news. The censors have been in gear saying the usual, this is good, we're doing okay, folks. There's a little bit to worry about on the horizon, but we'll pull through.
And Jocelyn, when you say happy news, what does that mean?
I once worked inside China's state media for China Radio International. And basically, we were told you can have a few critical articles or news reports out there, but we want the vast majority of them to be upbeat and positive. So oftentimes what we do is you package a story as there was this problem, but we've solved it, or we're on our way to solve it. You do not report on problems before they're solved. And we've seen a certain amount of that with the Chinese media in the financial crisis.
So it's almost outside the realm of pure propaganda and into a way of finessing the economy, which is so much based on psychology and anxiety.
If you want your people to keep on spending to keep the economy going, because now domestic demand is all that much more important in China, for both China and the world, then why not print news that's going to make people feel a little bit better? They're trying to stop housing prices from falling, to stop people from getting too scared and not buying stuff. So we're not going to print all that bad news all the time.
Weekend America is going to be the new official happy news organ of the United States government. I think we should apply for a grant.
Your economic problems will be over. The world will be a better place.
Perfect.
Hey, join the crowd.
Jocelyn Ford is an independent journalist based in Beijing. Jocelyn, thanks.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
Justin's car accident left him in a coma. Eventually, he awoke and was allowed to leave the hospital. Follow him on his first weekend home, next on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We have another installment from our series, First Weekend Home. Traumatic brain injury, or injury caused by a severe blow to the head, is the leading cause of death and disability for children and young adults. One of the most common causes of those injuries is car accidents. That's how Texas high school student Justin Logan wound up in the hospital a few months ago. Reporter Tori Marlin follows Justin out of rehab and through his first weekend home in his mother's care.
On a recent Friday morning, 17-year-old Justin Logan and his mother, Judy, stand in a lobby at the Texas Neuro Rehab Center in Austin. A tracheotomy scar peeks out from under the neckline of Justin's T-shirt. As he waits for his discharge papers, a rehab technician comes to wish him well.
Take care, okay?
Okay.
Come back and visit me.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember my name?
No. I'm sorry.
Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. I forget every time.
I know. You gotta remember.
Huh. Justin doesn't remember a lot of things these days, including the terrible accident that landed him here. 3 months ago, he was riding shotgun in a friend's pickup truck when it veered off a state highway and flipped several times. The driver and another boy survived with minor injuries. The girl sitting behind Justin died at the scene. Justin was ejected and suffered a severe traumatic brain injury. He says he's glad he forgot this particular experience.
I'm sure I would have bad memories.
He was in a coma for 3 weeks after the accident. When he came to, he couldn't speak, walk, or even swallow. He would get easily agitated and hit people. He would say bizarre things.
Weird, off-the-wall things.
That's Justin's mother, Judy.
I don't want to go back to Vietnam. Or he would think that he was older and he was out of college already.
Actually, at the time of the accident, Justin did seem older than his years. He'd become a father at 15 and was working two jobs to pay for his son's diapers and daycare. In other ways, though, he was a typical teen in Llano, a small town in central Texas. He enjoyed playing video games, fishing. He was a linebacker for his varsity football team, the Yellow Jackets. But now his gait is uneven, and the muscles in his right arm are stiff. Its default position is bent at the elbow.
He misses playing football, and he wishes he could do it again. But out of the question, he won't be doing that.
Justin's physical challenges seem minor compared to his memory loss. He's forgotten some life-altering events, like that his father was murdered last year. In the hospital, Judy had to remind him over and over about it.
He would ask, "Where's my daddy?" And I'm like, "Justin, don't you remember he died, you know, a year ago, and you went to the funeral?" He goes, "No, I don't remember."
Hearing repeatedly about his father's death wasn't like reliving it. It was more like being reminded of a distant event until it became a remembered fact.
It's kind of sad. I still loved him.
On Justin's first weekend home, Judy finds herself in the role of caregiver. When he showers, she plants herself outside the bathroom door, ready to help if needed. She has to drive him everywhere. She has to keep him under 24-hour supervision.
So I can't just walk out the door and leave him here like we're so used to doing.
Judy and Justin have always liked to tease each other, and they seem to cope with their new situation with humor. On Saturday afternoon, at Justin's favorite barbecue restaurant, Judy tries to convince him that he likes onions and pickles, condiments that have always repulsed him. He doesn't fall for it.
I tried.
Yeah, you tried, but you failed.
Joking may help keep things light, but Judy has her limits. Like when Justin fakes a stumble or pretends to choke on his food. Over lunch, Judy asks him to stop doing that.
It's not funny to me.
It is to me.
You're the only one who thinks it's funny.
Judy tries to explain why his family might not appreciate the scare.
It was different for us, waiting and waiting and worrying while you were just kind of like out of it.
I don't remember it.
I know. We do.
Y'all are all waiting, aren't you?
We didn't know.
The next day, Judy's small duplex swells with family and friends who've come to welcome Justin home. Among them are Justin's 2-year-old son, Michael, and Michael's mother, Cecilia.
Justin, you doing all right? Are you hungry?
No.
I hope you are.
Michael gives his father a quick hug before scrambling off into another room. Minutes later, The boy reappears with a small red football and hands it to Justin. Justin doesn't say anything. He just holds the football on his lap. Before the accident, he was teaching Michael how to catch. Although Justin can't remember much about how he used to spend time with his son, the gaps in his shared history with Cecilia trouble him more. He doesn't remember basic things, like how they met, what went through his mind when he found out she was pregnant, or that they broke up a year ago. Cecilia has had to remind him of that more times than she can count.
If it's not every day, it's every other day. And sometimes it's like twice a day. He thinks we're a couple still sometimes, and that's been hard to deal with.
Justin concentrates hard on her every word. It's the first time I've seen his demeanor change. He looks forlorn.
I didn't believe her at first. It sucked. I wish we didn't break up.
As with his father's death, any insight or wisdom that came to Justin as a result of living through this heartbreak is now lost to him. The accident erased that. But simply knowing that he had grieved and moved on is a necessary step in his recovery. Justin is creating new memories now, and they'll shape who he is and who he will become. In Llano, Texas, I'm Tori Marlin for Weekend America.
This weekend, Justin and Judy will be taking Michael to the zoo, and Justin is hoping they'll make it to a seafood place where he can order some crab legs. That's one of the foods that he missed most. Justin's story was part of our first Weekend Home series. We followed soldiers back from Iraq and immigrants being introduced to their new home. It's all about coming home, and that can mean a lot of different things. I vividly remember when I bought my first home. It was 11 years ago now. We moved in. We got our stuff inside. It was our first weekend in our own home, my wife and I. And exhausted, I sat on the couch, and then heard the noise of the busy street nearby. It was crazy loud, and I thought, oh no, we've made a terrible mistake. We have to sell our house or get the money back. All my elation over home ownership vanished. It was a weekend of deep remorse. Of course, within a month, I didn't notice, and we lived there for 10 years. We did get some thick new windows, though. We want your stories of returning to your old stomping grounds, settling in somewhere new, maybe welcoming a family member home. Go to weekendamerica.org and share your first weekend home story. Maybe we'll share it with America.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
Remember when Barack Obama was first elected? All that promise, all that hope, what went wrong? That perspective I had on Weekend America. We'll be right back. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and it's time to listen to your weekend soundtrack, the song that you hear on your iPod through the weekend, or maybe just something that plays in your mind all weekend long, or perhaps the song that's on your mind as the weekend approaches. Our latest story comes from Jim Leftwich in Skokie, Illinois. His soundtrack is Friday on My Mind by Richard Thompson.
Monday morning feels so bad. Everybody seems to nag me. Coming Tuesday, I feel better. Even my old man looks good. Wednesday just won't go. Thursday goes too slow. I've got Friday on my mind.
Aside from the obvious reasons, why is this your weekend soundtrack?
Well, I remember when that song first came out, I was 17 years old, living in Kansas City, going to high school, putting myself through high school as I worked during the day. And, you know, it was a pretty grueling week, and when the weekend came around, that was the song that heralded it in for me.
What kind of work were you doing?
Oh, I was actually working in a machine shop on a lathe and on a drill press.
What was your life like back then?
It was pretty tough. I had left home when I was 17. My parents had moved to Chicago. I didn't want to move because I was in high school. And so when it, I was working during the week, going to high school, and when Friday came around, it was, a pretty good time, something to look forward to.
I know of nothing else that bugs me more than working for the rich man. Hey, I'll change that scene someday.
And it was called kind of a blue-collar anthem, and I think that's what it was. It was sort of a rebellious song and talked about losing your head and kind of letting everything go on the weekend.
Gonna have fun in the city. Be with my girl, she's so pretty. She looks fine tonight. She is out of sight to me.
What parts of it resonate for you the most? Are there certain passages that really stick with you?
I think the one about no more working for the rich man. I'm going to change that tune someday, which, means kind of getting out of the factory. And that was kind of a goal. So.
Well, now, you don't work in a factory anymore.
No.
Do you have people who work for you?
I have in the past. I don't anymore, but I have in the past, yeah.
So you probably see where I'm going with this.
Sure, yeah. I had turned into that guy.
How do you feel about that?
A little bit ambivalent about it. It's one of those things that you want to do, you strive for. I was never a real type of a management type, so I tend to try and get good people and just let them do what they do, so I hopefully haven't turned into the guy that they were singing about in that song.
You don't want to be the rich man.
Well, no, I do want to be the rich man. I just don't want the obligation.
Okay. Leftwich of Skokie, Illinois. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So what's your weekend soundtrack? What are you listening to all weekend long? Me, on the weekend, I spend time with my kids, my family, and I try to play different songs for them. And every time they switch it back, my kids switch it back to Rockin' the Suburbs by Ben Folds. Every time. So that's my weekend soundtrack. What's yours? Let's share it with America. Let's put everybody into your iPod. Go to weekendamerica.org and let us know.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We are now 11 days past an historic election where we were promised a new day in Washington. President-elect Barack Obama addressed a huge crowd in Grant Park in Chicago. People wept. Oprah wept. There was a whole lot of yes, we can going on. There was change in the air. We even found out that there would be a new puppy in the White House. And anyone who's had a new puppy in their own house knows about that kind of change. But people voted for change of the political variety anyway, partly because President Bush and this Congress were among the least popular in history. There's a lot of frustration out there. And partly because Americans believe we can always do better. Even through all those in-the-dirt approval numbers, Americans have optimism. A Pew study in October found only 11% of Americans were happy with how things were going, but most people, 64%, believed we can always find a way to solve our problems. Well, not so fast. Week in America's Ben Adair talked to some people who were skeptical of the past administration and are skeptical of the one to come, too.
The rest of you, rejoicing in a newfound optimism, now is not the time to give up what has been so close to your heart for so long, your worry.
Let me be the dark cloud on the Obama horizon.
Ben Weisner is a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, and he is very worried about closing the prison at Guantanamo Bay.
One of the things that we've been hearing a lot, even in recent days, is that closing Guantanamo will be massively complicated because what do you do with all of these terrorists who can't be prosecuted but who also can't be released? And there have even been policies floated that perhaps we need a new national security court system, some new authority for how to detain dangerous terrorists without prosecuting them.
How we deal with terrorism suspects is one of the toughest questions facing the incoming administration. Civil liberties advocates like Weisner argue that our justice system is perfectly suited, as is, for dealing with the criminals at Guantanamo. His worry is that as Close Guantanamo goes from campaign slogan to policy, that this argument some suspects are too dangerous, despite the evidence, or that some evidence is too secret, will become a parting gift to George W. Bush.
If the final legacy of Guantanamo is that the prison is closed, but that what that prison represents is enshrined into American law, we'll be in a worse place than we were even before.
Here's another for you. You think a guy like John White, who runs a company called the Center for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technologies, you think he'd be sleeping well at night, right?
Well, I'm sleeping better because it's like Happy New Year with Obama. You know, it's like we finally, our long national nightmare is over, and there is a palpable, when you woke up the next day, there was a sense of great hope. At the same time, there is a sense of great risk and great danger.
It's true that Obama has proposed, for example, a massive upgrade to our entire energy grid. He talks concretely about energy independence. And it's true that Al Gore is in the running for a new cabinet-level position, something along the lines of energy czar. John White says, forget energy, forget environmentalism. We are not taking any of this seriously enough.
I don't think we have yet put these crises in the context of national security, which is where I think they belong. I think our dependence on oil, combined with the threat of climate change, is a singular threat to our nation's security. Think about building solar plants as the same as building liberty ships. We're in a race against time.
The first betrayal is always the hardest. And for Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, and liberals, the biggest worry as candidate Obama becomes president is which of his promises will end up unfulfilled. Because a lot of them will. The question is, how many? When? In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Adair for Weekend America.
Today is National Adoption Day. Every year, American families adopt nearly 20,000 children from abroad. The kids come from orphanages and foster care. For a lot of them, there's very little stability in their lives, and they're deprived of things that kids in more permanent family situations have. And that leads to a lot of stress. researchers at the University of Minnesota have taken an interest in these children and their stress levels. They're studying how early deprivation, like what a child experiences in an orphanage, can affect a child's stress response system. Weekend America's Sasha Aslanian visited the university's child development lab in Minneapolis.
10-year-old Sam Gorchalski stands at a podium at a university conference room giving a 5-minute speech to two adults posing as a teacher and a school principal. In this pretend scenario, Sam's accused of stealing his best friend's lunch money, and he has to defend himself.
The kind of person that would steal lunch money is a bully, and I'm not a bully.
You're not done yet. Keep going.
I'm trying to think of something.
You know this feeling. People are staring at you. Your mind goes blank. Your heart is beating. You start to sweat. Dr. Megan Gunner studies the neurobiology of stress. She's the mastermind behind Sam's speech exercise.
It activates stress biology because it threatens our social self. We like to look good. We like to be accepted by others. Being evaluated in a social setting is very stressful.
Sam spent the first 4 years of his life in a Romanian orphanage. He's been with his adopted family for 6 years. The theory is that a kid like Sam, who's been through much worse stress in his life, won't think this is any big deal. Next door, Sam's mom, Phyllis Hames, is watching him on a video monitor.
Handsome little devil.
Yeah.
Parents can step in if they think their child is getting too distressed. Sam's still smiling and doesn't look perturbed. One of the researchers sitting with us, Bonnie Donzella, has a more practiced eye.
So he's got the body things going, where, you know, you've got that little nervous, whoa, energy that wants to find a place to go, so people will pound on the lectern and do crazy, non-meaningful gestures. He's got a little of that going.
Sam's mom describes him as a sociable little guy who loves to talk, but the speech has clearly taken him out of his element. It's a little painful to watch, but then it's over. Now he has to take a math test. During these exercises, Sam's heart rate goes up and his brain fires off a stress hormone called cortisol. Cortisol goes into his bloodstream and traces of it show up in saliva. So after the exercises, Donzella says Sam will spit into a cup so his stress level can be measured.
So we'll be getting a measure of how stressed they were during probably the early part of the speech, the initial when you come in, and then they'll start becoming more like recovery measures. Like, once freaked out, do they maintain that state? Or do they go, all right, fine, that's done, and do they come right back down?
The speech and math exercises are designed to fire up three parts of Sam's brain: the hippocampus, which deals with memory, the amygdala, which perceives threats, and the prefrontal cortex, which is where he does his critical thinking. Megan Gunner, the lead researcher, says orphanage life keeps these parts of the brain revved up, looking for threats.
Chronic adversity will begin to tone the system for defensive responding at lower thresholds so that we react first, think later, which, of course, is adaptive.
But Gunner calls the stress system a big gun. Firing it too often, she says, has consequences.
So if you have a child who's developing with a system that's beginning to be toned that way, then they go into school and they're reacting and being defensive and being anxious and not being able to pay attention and having trouble playing well with other children because they perceive threats too easily.
Sam got out of the orphanage years ago, but Gunner is curious if his early life affects the way he continues to sense and react to stressful events. So international adoptees like Sam are compared to a control group of kids growing up with their biological families.
And what we found was no difference.
No difference between the adoptees like Sam, the kids who endured the most stress in early life, and the control group of kids raised in their biological families, the most protected kids. The speech and math tests stressed them both out. But there was another group of kids included in the study. These children were adopted not from orphanages, but from foster care abroad when they were less than a year old. They had had some stress early in life, but less than Sam.
So the surprise in looking at these kids is that their stress biology was lower. They looked buffered. They looked like they'd had a sort of stress inoculation effect.
Gunner's hypothesis is that a little stress helps temper the body's stress response. She wants to do more research and make sure the pattern holds true past puberty and see what having a less reactive stress system bodes for child development. After decades of pioneering work on kids and stress, Gunner's latest findings surprised her a bit. Once she mulled it over, though, they seemed to fit. the stress system develops from use. If it's fired up too often, it develops a hair trigger. If it's not exercised enough, the child doesn't learn to cope.
If you never have a chance to manage anything challenging at all in your life until you're an adult, you're not really well suited to manage being an adult. Too much overwhelms the system. You begin to think of yourself as incapable and incompetent, and the world is hostile and mean, and so on, and you do not manage stress very well.
So one less thing for parents to feel guilty about. A little stress is okay. A little. In St. Paul, I'm Sasha Aslanian for Weekend America.
We have an audio slideshow about the groundbreaking work Megan Gunner has done on kids' stress levels in daycare. Check it out at weekendamerica.org. Of all the things you could be doing this weekend, apparently shopping isn't high on your list. Retail sales were down 2.8% in October, steepest decline in 16 years. So if not the mall, where will you go? Jeannie Yandel has some ideas.
Hawaii is almost unfairly beautiful, but legions of sweaty, shaky caffeine addicts make the Big Island a little less appealing during the Kona Coffee Festival. 78 and cloudy for coffee tastings, and if you can stay put long enough, a coffee-themed parade. Laymaking workshops should be fun to watch. Imagine all those coffee fiends trying to sit still and string flowers together. Merengue is the official music and dance of the Dominican Republic. Dancing couples move to fast Latin Caribbean rhythms, a perfect fit for Massachusetts in November. The good folks of Roxbury shake their hips at the Day of Merengue. Learn to merengue, check out merengue-inspired art, and eat Caribbean food. Rainy and 60 degrees, so your raincoat will squeak alluringly as you step to the beat. The one lesson the movie Jurassic Park taught us was do not spend time outside with dinosaurs. McKinney, Texas thumbs its nose at Hollywood with Dinos After Dark. Clear in 33 for night hiking with a dozen animatronic dinosaurs, and then for sleeping outside with a dozen animatronic dinosaurs. McKinney, Texas, what are you thinking? Are you building some houses on an old burial ground next? For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
There are plenty of teams in the National Basketball Association, but which one should you root for? Players and executives try to win your heart next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. A couple of weeks ago, I found myself in a gym in downtown Minneapolis watching tall, sweaty men play basketball. I was looking for love. Let me back up. All my life, I've cheered for one pro basketball team, the Seattle Supersonics. Do you know the starting lineup of the Sonics' 1979 championship team? Gus Williams, Dennis Johnson, John Johnson, Lonnie Shelton, Jack Sigma.
Look, I've followed a lot of bad Sonics teams too. That's part of the deal. It's a marriage and there's no divorce, for better or for worse, until death do us part. And the Sonics have died. A few months ago, they moved to Oklahoma City, becoming the Oklahoma City Thunder. That name feels like hair on my tongue. My basketball spouse is dead. So I'm free to remarry. You know what? Let's actually drop this whole love, marriage, death analogy because it's kind of creepy. How about this? I'm now a fan-free agent. So I contacted teams all over the league to see if they wanted to sign me as a fan now that I'm on the open market. And an overwhelming number of them did not respond, but a few did. The Minnesota Timberwolves were those tall, sweaty guys I mentioned earlier. I sat down with Assistant General Manager Fred Hoiberg after a recent practice.
We're one of two teams that brings back three 40% three-point shooters from a season ago, the other team being the Lakers. So Ryan Gomes, capable shooter. Kevin Love has such a unique skill set to get Al Jefferson the ball. He's another guy that can shoot the NBA three.
I love talking hoops with Hoiberg. Stats, schemes, he's got a great basketball mind.
Well, I think we'll improve this year, absolutely. You know, Randy Foy missed the first 44 games last season with a knee injury. You know, when he played that last month, once he got his timing back, our last 24 games, we played at almost 500 ball.
While that information was great, what about me and my needs? I cut to the chase. Do you want to sign me as a fan? Are you welcoming me into the Timberwolves franchise, Fred Hoiberg?
I am absolutely welcoming you into our franchise. We could use some fans right now, and if you jump on board now, you know there should
I fit in with the scheme. I fit in with what you're running in terms of fans.
Yeah, you're part of the blueprint. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking to some other teams. I'm talking to the Suns and the Bucks, but I'll let you know.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
The Phoenix Suns offered Rick Welts. Rick's their president and chief operating officer, and he's been in the league a long time. He was the media relations guy for the Sonics in that 1979 championship year. I asked him why I should be a fan.
I find it a lot harder to come up with reasons why you wouldn't. I would just say Shaquille O'Neal, the quote machine, anchors our center spot. So there's never a dull moment when Shaq's in the house.
Okay, so we got Shaq.
You know, then I would say we've got the rookie with the best hair in the league in Robin Lopez, who looks like he stuck his finger in an electrical outlet.
Remember, Rick's a media guy, so he wanted to give me, a journalist, good storylines, characters, something entertaining.
And the Phoenix Gorilla, who's a mainstay and has been for almost the entire history of our franchise, so we're not lacking for entertainment value off the court either.
It's a guy in a gorilla suit. He dunks. So Phoenix is all about fun. They'd be perfect if I was 4 years old and not very bright. If Minnesota was too dry, Phoenix was too silly. I kept looking. The Milwaukee Bucks, they must have wanted me really bad. They put starting center Andrew Bogut on the line with me. The Australian Bogut is a former number one overall NBA draft pick and a future star in the league. I asked him, why be a Bucks fan?
Why? Well, first of all, we've got an Australian playing for Milwaukee Bucks, so I think that's probably the best reason. We've also got a prince from Africa. You know, if you ever want to go to Africa and be looked after, we've got you back there as well. Luke Mabute, he's a prince of his village in Cameroon, so.
The Bucks have an African prince. Royalty.
Give it here to Cameroon, you know, you can get the five-star treatment.
Right. I could just flash my some Bucks gear.
Oh, you'll be good, yeah. You'll probably get a crown.
I do like crowns. Seriously, the Bucks are on the rise. Milwaukee as a city is great. I enjoy beer. And their star player directly asked me to be a fan. And he made jokes. What else do you need? I had one more team I wanted to talk to. The Memphis Grizzlies. General Manager Chris Wallace spoke from the team bus between games in Oakland and Sacramento.
I used to work in politics, and you've got to grab people by the heart, grab their emotions first, then their head will follow.
Wallace said that even though the team is bad at the moment, I should become a fan now so that when they get good later, I'll have been part of a movement of believers. He drew on his political background with an approach straight out of the Yes We Can playbook.
Everybody wants to be ahead of their time. I mean, how would it have felt to have been the first guy on your block to recognize Barack Obama a couple years ago as the next president of the United States?
Wallace was clever to bring up the Grizzlies' future to me, of all people. The team is not doing well in Memphis as a business and could eventually be sold and moved to Seattle. The Sonics team name is even available for some future team there. They could be my beloved, resurrected at last. But then, Memphis would be heartbroken. How could I root for that to happen to them? You know what? The love and marriage analogy was the right one after all. I'm in mourning for my basketball spouse. And these other teams, well, they're all super nice and I had a great time talking to them, but it's too soon. I just want to be friends. I'm going to hold on to the Timberwolves number, though, and here's why. When I was at that practice, Mike Miller, a guard on the team, was shooting free throws. Occasionally, the ball would carom off and bounce over to me. I picked it up, threw it back to him. And each time I did, Miller said, "Thank you. Thank you." Pro basketball is a business and a passion and kind of a mess. But if there is some humanity in there somewhere, yeah, I can be a fan of that. The Timberwolves are in action against Portland tonight. A lot of my fellow Seattle fans are now rooting for Portland, a team that has two Seattle-area players on the roster, and their coach used to coach the Sonics as well, but the Trailblazers never call me back, so I can't root for them. Milwaukee takes on the world champion Boston Celtics tonight. Good luck, Andrew Bogut. And sorry, Boston fans, I couldn't possibly latch on to the world champions and start cheering for the Celtics now. I don't want to be that guy. The Suns play the Detroit Pistons tomorrow. The Memphis Grizzlies, they have the weekend off. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of the entire show at weekendamerica.org. Enjoy your weekend. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Home movies are embarrassing enough at home. Imagine them playing at a rock concert. I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, meet a musician who plugs in his amp, his old projector, and all his memories.
There's a lot of people I think that would prefer not to share their home movies with other people. They wouldn't want people to see them. For me, I've really made the decision to make them more public.
Imagine being on stage with your own past. Join us.